Okay, I'm going to do the introduction when we play it back this afternoon, so I'll just start. Okay. The first group that you organized was called the Smoothies, and I think you were really inspired by the vocal harmonies of the high lows and the four lads. What appealed to you about those kinds of harmonies?
Just the fact that they were, you know, complex and contrapuntal, and I always loved the Four Freshmen very, very much, and I loved the way they used the tenor lead, and it was just so musical. You know, I got to know the high lows quite well. Actually, later, after I'd formed the Mamas and Papas, the fellow who sang that phenomenal tenor part for them, Clark Burrows, became a good friend of mine out in California.
When you organized your group, the Smoothies, did you all dress in a certain way or have a certain style for performances?
Exactly. We had a big S, like a Superman thing, on our blue blazers. And we wore gray pants, you know, and blue blazers and rep ties and all of that stuff.
What about rock and roll? You were listening to rock and roll also, weren't you?
Yeah, but it was mostly jazz, you know. Bobby Troup, Julie London, Shorty Rogers, Shelly Mann, things like that.
When you look back at that group that you formed, that first group, does it seem ultra straight to you?
Well, the times were ultra straight also. It was the end of the 50s. And it was a funny group because, we opened with Forget Your Troubles, Come On, Get Happy was our opening number in our live act, you know, in four-part harmony, you know.
One of the people you performed with back in the early 60s was Phil Blondheim, who later changed his name to Scott McKenzie and had a big hit with San Francisco. Did you both try to, like, cover up that part of your musical career at all?
No.
Once you got into, like, more rock-oriented pop music?
Well, no, we went from the Smoothies into folk music, actually.
Right, well, that's true, yeah.
And Scott and I sang in The Journeyman. Scott and I were from the same hometown, you know, from Alexandria, Virginia. All of the Smoothies were from the same neighborhood in Alexandria, Virginia. And we just used to sing on the corner, you know, and that's how we first, you know, we were a lamppost group. And
a cappella.
Yeah, just doo-wops and stuff, you know. And then we just got more and more complex harmonies and things. And I just wanted to mention the fact that Scott still plays. He plays in the Mamas and Papas band now, and we've been friends for, God, 30 years.
I'm not sure if it was with the Journeyman. I guess it was with the Journeyman that you actually had a hit and ended up on Bandstand.
And right.
And the Journeymen were being touted as the next Kingston Trio type.
Yeah, I mean, we were called the Four Freshmen of folk music. I saw some tapes the other day, some videotapes of the Journeyman performances on, you know, live performances and on live TV things on the Hootenanny show and things like that, you know. And I was amazed at how good, you know, the Journeymen were and how fantastically in tune everyone sang and all that. I never remembered it being that way.
Just to put this all in context, what was on the charts then?
Oh, gosh. The charts were sort of dominated by Conway Twitty and Elvis Presley. Whatever they were doing, that was what was top of the charts. And Frankie Avalon and the whole Philadelphia group of people. Fabian, Be My Teddy Bear.
What were the first signs to you that things were going to change for you musically and socially, that you're going to enter a different period, that you're going to go from folk to a more pop kind of rock, and that you were going to kind of turn more to, like, the hippie counterculture than the folky beatnik? Because you've just gone through so many different changes.
Yeah, well, you know, folk music just sort of died a natural death around 1964, 63. I mean, there was just no more market for it, really, at all. And the reason we had gone into folk music in the first place was because we really didn't like, singing from Bobby Socks to Blue Jeans kind of material. And it didn't interest us at all. We met a fellow named Dick Weissman in Greenwich Village, who's a musicologist, and he's a professor of music now at Boulder. The University of Colorado in Boulder. He played with us in The Journeyman. And he really sort of opened our eyes to folk music and the beauties of it. You know, it was much more satisfying to play that than to sing with Dick Clark all the time and go around, you know, doing these rock and roll shows and these funny songs.
Did the Beatles have anything to do with the demise of the Journeymen?
Well, no, the Journeymen demised all by themselves. They didn't need any help. Scott thought that we were trying to poison him, and he went into a mental home for a while. And we were in Tallahassee, Florida one morning, and Scott walked in and said to Dick and I, said, I know you've been trying to poison me for months, and it's no secret anymore. The secret's out, and I'm leaving you. I'll never sing with you guys again. And Dick was sick of being on the road on one-nighters. Dick said, you're right, we have been. You know? And he went up to a cabin up in the mountains, and I went back to New York and formed the New Journeymen with Marshall Brickman, who later won an Academy Award for Annie Hall as a screenplay writer with Woody Allen, and Michelle Phillips. And then we found out that, well, none of us really had a lead voice between Michelle, Marshall, and I. We sang great harmony, but there was no lead. And I'd heard Denny Doherty sing before, and he has this wonderful Irish tenor voice. And so Marshall said, why don't you get Denny to sing, and I'll play banjo in the background. And that worked out really fine. And so that was the New Journeyman, who never actually recorded. But the funny thing is that Marshall, you know, is really known for his comic ability and as a writer, and now as a movie director. It was one of the guys who played in Dueling Banjos. He's one of the banjo players and is a fantastic musician. Well, he and Eric Weisberg. He and Eric Weisberg.
Oh, right. The dueling, yeah. The New Journeyman developed into the Mamas and Papas with the addition of Cass Elliot.
Right.
Now, how did she join the group?
Well, she was a good friend of Denny's, and she was also from the same hometown, from Alexandria, Virginia, the font of talent, you know, in Virginia. And she was 6 or 7 years younger than I was, and I didn't meet her until we got to New York. And Denny kept saying, you've got to meet this girl because she's heard all about you since you're from the same hometown, and she's a great singer, and she's funny, and she's bright and witty and all these things about her. And so finally one night he brought her by the house, and he was right about everything. I mean, she was really a tremendous person. But she sang a couple of tones too low for the harmonies that I had in mind. And so the lead pipe story, you know.
Yeah, is that really a true story? Why don't you tell the story?
It really is a true story, yeah. We were in the Virgin Islands, and Michelle and Denny and I were singing on stage as the journeyman, the New Journeyman. And Cass was waiting tables in this restaurant and trying to convince us that she could sing with us, you know. A wonderful singer like Cass, you know, waiting the tables, and we're up there singing, and she's trying to convince us to let her join the group, and we're saying, no, your range is too low. And they were doing some construction work there, and a workman happened to drop a 6-inch lead pipe, and it landed on Cass's head from 30 feet up, and it gave her a concussion, and she went to the hospital for a couple of days, and she came back, and for some reason, she was able to sing a tone and a half, 2 tones higher than she had when she went in the hospital. And from then on, her voice fitted in perfectly into the harmonies.
You write in your book about how surprised you were the first time you saw her because she was so big. Did you ever go through this thing of thinking, how would she look on stage and would it be bad for the group's image to have someone who's really fat in the group?
No, that never occurred to me, but it sure occurred to Cass. I mean, Cass said she would never go on stage on the same stage as Michelle because Michelle was so slim and so pretty, and Cass felt that she looked awful next to Michelle, but she looked all right with a couple of guys around her, but not anywhere near Michelle. And it took us a long time to convince Cass to go on stage and to perform live with Michelle as her singing partner. But the first time she did it, and she realized that Michelle had beauty and all this, but that Cass really had the warmth and the personality and could just grab the audience with her vocal ability, things that Michelle couldn't do. From then on, Cass was, what's the big problem here, you know? Get this little thing out of here. I'll take care of everything.
My guest is John Phillips, who founded the group The Mamas and Papas, and he's written an autobiography called Papa John. Michelle, who you referred to, was your second wife, and you met her, mm-hmm. just to fill everybody in, when you were about 26 or something.
Yeah, I was about 26, and she was about 16.
And you married her. You left your first wife for her, and
yeah.
And ended up performing together, even though she didn't initially plan on going into music. Why did you decide to include her in the group? Because she hadn't been a performer.
No, as a matter of fact, you know, she'd grown up in Mexico, and she'd never sung professionally at all. But we would go on these long road trips with the journeymen, and she would always travel with us. And we would sing in the car. And as this went on for like 3 years, you know, being on the road. And she just got better and better and better. And she had a real street sense of rock and roll. She had a better street sense of rock and roll than Cass had. Cass had an incredible technique and tone and all these things. Michelle really had that sort of Phil Spector kind of, you know, the Ronettes kind of, you know, or the Shangri-Las or something like that. You know, she would have fit right into that group perfectly. So it was a nice balance of technique and raw talent between the two of them.
What was your concept for the group in terms of the production of the record and the vocal harmonies that you were working?
I wanted to have a group that was two guys and two girls and that would have featured soloists and a lot of answer back harmonies and things like that, you know. And Lou Adler was very responsible for taking what I did with just one guitar and vocal arrangements. I mean, we could sing anything live, you know, because everyone knew how to sing and all that. But he found, like, the best musicians on the West Coast and put them behind us, like really good rock musicians like Hal Blaine and Larry Nechtel and Joe Osborne and people like that. And the mixture of those things, once again, it was like, you know, that's where Lou's genius as a producer really lies, in finding someone who can really write good songs, someone who can really sing well, and then get a great band and put it all together. And that's what a producer should do, you know.
That's the producer who signed you.
Yeah.
How did he first hear the band, the group?
Well, whatever it was, the band of gypsies. He had just done Eve of Destruction with Barry McGuire on his a label called Dunhill Records, which was distributed by ABC. And we were living, and 10 of us in this little apartment off Sunset Strip. And Barry had a brand new motorcycle and all these things that, accrements of wealth that he had gotten from his number one hit, Eve of Destruction. And he heard us sing, Barry did, and we had known Barry for years from the village and all that. And he said, "You guys ought to come down and meet this fellow, Lou Adler, who's producing my records. I think he'd like what you do, you know." So we were like a real strange-looking group of people, and we went down to the studio that night, and Lou took a look at us, and I don't think he expected very much out of us, you know, because I was 6'4" or 6'5", whatever I am, and weighed nothing at all, you know. Denny had a very clipped Canadian accent, and Cass weighed 270 pounds, and Michelle looked like a waif, and we were starving to death, you know. I had a great 12-string guitar. So finally, they got a break, and he said, "Okay, go in the other studio and warm up and sing." I said, "Well, we don't have to warm up. We're all ready now. Let's just sing for you." So we sang the entire first album with just the one guitar, but with all the contrapuntal harmonies and things. And Lou said, "Oh, yeah, my God, that's wonderful." You know, he immediately saw the potential of it, you know. We signed with Dunhill the next day, and he bought us a car and gave us a house and a charge account. And it was like, you know, the Hollywood fairy story come true, you know.
Some producers who see the potential in a band then dress them up in all kinds of arrangements that they don't fit into.
Yeah.
Did you have to fight for that at all? He had a good sense of what would be good for you?
Yeah, he just left us alone. He's, you know, as a matter of fact, like California Dreaming was originally done as a track for Barry McGuire. And when Lou heard the song, he thought that would be a great follow-up for Barry for Eve of Destruction.
I can't see that, actually.
Well, it didn't work out. But that original track and the original background vocals were cut for a Barry McGuire album. And then it's on Barry's album, as a matter of fact, with the Mamas and Papas singing all the backgrounds on that album. But it just didn't sound right. And then Lou said to himself, "Well, why don't you let, well, we'll have Denny sing it also, you know." And Denny sings an octave higher than Barry. And he put Denny on it, and all of a sudden it went boom, and this beautiful sound. And that's how California Dreaming was actually made. It was made for Barry McGuire.
But then it was remade for...
It wasn't remade. I mean, we put the lead on top of the track we did for Barry.
Oh, so it was just right on top of that.
Yeah.
That's really amazing.
I took Barry's voice off and put Denny's on, and that was it.
Did you think that the group was going to catch on? Did it fit into any kind of genre, as far as you could tell? Because that's how groups are usually marketed, you know, by fitting into a certain category that already exists.
We had a very difficult time finding a record deal, you know. And our material also was not the kind of material that was very popular at the time, you know. Like California Dreaming wasn't about, you know, boys and girls and love and all that stuff. And, you know, it was about, you know, young people's quest for, you know, rebellion and trying to find a new lifestyle, a new way to live. And that's what most of the songs were about, or about personal relationships and friends and things like that, you know. So people said no one's interested in that kind of stuff, you know, in the top 40 market. Well, of course, they were wrong, but it took someone like Lou with the foresight to say, you know, I'm interested in this. I like it, you know. And he's always gone by his instincts, you know. He did Sam Cooke. He did Johnny Rivers, and he also did Carole King. His great album, Tapestry.
My guest is John Phillips, and he's written an autobiography called Papa John. Well, as soon as the Mamas and Papas signed a 5-year contract, which wedded them together for 5 years, things started to break apart in the group a little bit. It was right after you signed the contract, right, that you found out your lover, Michelle, was actually sleeping with Denny from the group.
Yeah.
that must have been really devastating.
It was, yeah. It was very hard. It wasn't just my lover, Michelle. It was my wife, Michelle, by that point.
Yeah. Even
We'd
worse.
We'd gone past that point, yeah. It was Denny's lover, my wife. What it really was. It was sort of devastating, you know, and Cass was, you know, deeply in love with Denny, and Denny loved Cass as a brother and sister sort of thing, you know, and gosh, I don't know, it seems like we just had to leave everything outside the studio, you know, and when we got into the studio, just make the music, and that was the only thing that eased the tension was working continually.
You know what's funny to me? You're listening to these records, you say, wow, I bet this group has such a good time together.
We did.
Did you?
Yeah, in sort of an unconventional way.
Uh-huh. Because I'm thinking, like, gosh, you know, you just never know if people are at each other's throats or carrying on behind each other's backs and stuff. And you always think, oh, it just must be great to tour together and so on. And
well, you know, we all lived in the same house for years. And, you know, it was like a communal lifestyle, and it was sort of one of the first LSD communes, you know, that sprang up all over the country. You know, we had our own little commune of four people, and I think we did everything that 30 people could have done had they been there, you know. Every combination came forth.
Did you ever get into a thing of, well, sure, I'm jealous, but I should learn how to transcend jealousy, because jealousy is an outdated concept.
Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I did. You had mentioned that. But it was very hard for me to do, very, very hard for me to do. I still work with Denny. Denny and I are still partners. Michelle also had an affair with Scott, and I still work with Scott, you know. And Scott and I have been friends for, you know, years and years and years and years before this happened.
Was there a point where you decided to, like, give up on transcending jealousy and just admit?
Yeah, I didn't talk to Scott for 15 years, as a matter of fact. I got so angry at him.
Really?
Yeah, it was only 2 years ago that I started talking to Scott again. After that.
You mentioned that the house that you lived in as being, like, one of the first real, like, LSD type communes. Now, I get the impression that you actually did a lot of TV talk shows and stuff when you were tripping. And I can't imagine what an experience like that would be, and how absurd the whole thing must have seemed to you if you were really high and, I don't know, on the Johnny Carson show or the Merv Griffin, I don't know which shows
Ed
you were
Sullivan
doing.
Show mostly. Ed Sullivan show, mostly. That was really funny.
Well, that should
following
do it.
Topo Gigio.
Great.
You know, Cash used to say things like, you know, Ed, we're following the little mouse again, and we're not thrilled by that, you know? You know, on the air to Sullivan. And then when we were announcing our breakup, that we were going to, you know, go away, you know, and he said, well, where are you going? And I said, well, we're going to take the SS France. And he says, where does it go? And Michelle said, Ed, I think the France goes to France. If it was called the England, it would go to England. And things like that. It was, live TV was really a lot of fun, especially with Ed Sullivan, because you'd go out and he wouldn't move his lips and he'd say, "For God's sakes, help me." Because he wouldn't know who you were. He'd say, "Now the mommers and the poppers, or the peepers and the poopers," or, you know. He always had things all screwed up, you know. And it was hilarious just to work with him.
Oh, whenever he introduced a rock band or anything, it would always be, "And now for the youth, for the young people."
Right. But it was like a circus backstage, because there'd always be a juggler on the show and an animal act on the show, you know, and a comedian. And it was like, you know, real sort of a vaudeville TV.
When you tripped a lot, were you pretty sure you'd have a good trip?
Yeah, I never had a bad one, actually.
Never?
No. It was just one of those things. I don't know what happened. I don't think any of us ever did.
What were your trips like?
We never sort of tripped without, you know, the first time we ever took acid, we took it together, the four of us. And I think it was very, very seldom that we ever took it individually without all four of us being present. And so we always, and the first one was so much fun in its own free, you know, the sense of freedom it gave you at the time, that we always related back to that first trip, you know, and it was always sort of a recreation of that.
Wasn't it during that first trip that you actually listened very closely for the first time to the Beatles?
Well, yeah, I was forced to by Denny. He took the earphones and said, "Now listen to this," because I'd been sort of resisting, you know. My idea of rock and roll was Frankie Avalon and Fabian and all that kind of stuff. You know, stuff I really don't know, Johnny Tillotson and things. So this is Philadelphia. I better watch it here. These are all Philadelphia heroes, aren't they?
It's 2 out of 3. Yeah.
2 out of 3. Yeah. And you know, I didn't want to do that kind of music, and I hadn't really heard the Beatles at all. So Denny just clamped the earphones on me. He said, "I want you to listen to this album all the way through. You know, listen to it all the way through." He said, "And then write a lot of songs just like these." So I listened to it all the way through, and I started writing a lot of songs just like those. In a period of about 3 years, I wrote about 50 tunes that were all recorded by the Mamas and Papas during that burst of creativity we had.
What are some of the songs that you really think were inspired by the Beatles' early records?
Well, I think all of them were, really, you know. I mean, I'd already written California Dreamin', but I'd written Go Where You Wanna Go, but it was just I had written them as folk songs, you know, and they were done with acoustic guitar, and they were very delicate and sort of gentle kinds of things, and this opened up a whole new realm of possibility as to what you could do with the music, and that harmonies were going to be accepted again, and you could, you know, say intelligent things lyrically. It was like opening a big, wide gate for us. It was wonderful what the Beatles did for everyone.
You didn't tour a lot, right?
Well, we toured a lot. We didn't perform a lot. We canceled more jobs than we actually... we'd get to the city, you know, then we'd lose somebody. Like, we wouldn't know where Cass was, and it would come showtime, and St. Louis still won't have us back. I mean,
because you never showed up for the date?
Well, we showed up 4 times, but not with the whole group.
Oh, boy.
And so, you know, the promoters got sort of... We lost a fortune just buying our way out of dates, you know. We went to Europe twice and to perform and had to cancel the whole European tour because we had fights.
Really?
Yeah. Over nothing. I mean, just the little things, you know. But we were so successful recording that, you know, we didn't really care.
Since the group had such tight vocal harmonies, I wonder how much that came across in live performances anyways, knowing what most sound systems were like, especially then. I mean,
and audiences also.
Right. I mean, audiences screaming?
They just scream. You walk out on stage, they start screaming, and you could sing anything you wanted to sing in any key you wanted to, no matter what you were playing, or you didn't have to tune your guitar or do anything at all. Matter of fact, John Lennon said that... at the Shea Stadium concert, he's saying, "I want to hold your hand the entire show," over and over again. No matter what song was announced or what the band was, he just sang, "I want to hold your hand," for 25 minutes or 30 minutes.
And no one could hear the difference?
No one knew the difference. You know.
Did you ever truly understand the screaming?
No. I never was a screamer, you know, so I don't know. But I guess it's the need to participate, you know, in it. And I mean, this group that we have now, you know, with my daughter Mackenzie, and with Spanky McFarlane, Denny and myself, this group can really sing those songs live, and they sound wonderful. But a lot of that is due to the state-of-the-art equipment and the monitor systems now, and the echo that you can put on, and you can really hear what you're doing. And you know, the performers now are more highly tuned on stage to what's going on, and so are the musicians. I mean, the singers and the musicians, you know, as a unit and a blend, wasn't at all present in the 60s. It was just a madhouse. It was more of an event.
Right.
You know?
You threw Michelle out of the group for a while. Can you explain the circumstances behind that?
Well, I prefer to think of it as...
Yeah?
As, you know, when Michelle, you know... There was a group called the Birds, and a very good songwriter and guitar player and singer who's a very good friend of mine now also named Gene Clark in the group. And Michelle and I had broken up for the umpteenth time, and she was dating Gene, and we were playing at a place called Melody Land out in California. And Simon and Garfunkel were the opening act for us, and it was a big show that night. And Gene was sitting in the front row, and Michelle was playing to Gene, and I really got angry, and I felt very hurt, and I could not overcome my jealousy through mental training. So I just went to Cass and Denny, and I said, "Yeah, I just can't do this anymore. I can't really work under these circumstances." I said, "You know, either Michelle has to go or I have to go." I said, "I'm very willing to go out and form a new group or do anything, you know, but one of us has got to get out of here because it's driving me nuts, and I just can't do it." And so they said, "Well, throw her out. Let's get rid of her then." And so we went to the record company, and Lou said, "Well, whatever you guys want to do, you know." And so in Michelle's book, which is out right now called California Dreamin', she has a picture of the letter, you know, which is signed by everyone, not just by me, Terry. I couldn't keep her out of the group for long anyway because I was so in love with her. It didn't make much difference. You know, she was out for, I guess, 3 or 4 months tops, I suppose.
Well, I think it's in your book, or maybe it's in her book, there's a photograph of Jill, who was the woman who came in to replace...
Jill Gibson, yeah.
Yeah, of her superimposed in the place of the Mamas and Papas photo where Michelle used to be. And
They look very much alike to start with.
But it troubled me, though, that whoever was doing publicity or whatever would take this photograph and wipe out Michelle and just plunk somebody else in that spot. It
troubled you, did it?
Yeah.
Think how Michelle felt.
Yeah, I can imagine how she felt.
She slugged Denny.
Really?
Walked into the studio and slugged him, knocked him over the piano. Of course, Michelle has slugged quite a few people. Yeah, you know? She slugged me a lot of times, too.
And vice versa.
And vice versa. Right. Yeah, we used to have like, you know, real brawls, knockdown waterfront fights, you know.
Well, you became big stars and were able to fulfill whatever material fantasies you had. What did you want, you know, as far as that money could buy? What did you want to bring into your life?
It turned out there was nothing that money could buy that we really wanted.
Really?
That was the sad part of the whole thing.
You mean
we made all this money. And then on the last album, there's a song called Mansions that I wrote, you know, which says, why isn't this like the dream? You know, we made, everything came true that we said we were set out to get. We got our Grammy, we got this, we had our mansion, we had, you know, celebrity status, we had a lot of money, we had Rolls Royces, you know.
You had five of them, right?
Yeah, and no one was happy at all. You know, we were much happier when we were bumming around the islands with no money at all, but still singing the same songs, you know, with the same group of people.
So what did you do? I mean, did you want to sell the stuff? What happens once you get into that? You've been able to buy everything you wanted, then you realize it's not as good as you thought it was going to be. Does that mean you want to sell it or be broke again?
You really lose respect for it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, the material thing, that you really lose a lot of respect for it. And I think that was one of the reasons why when I got into drugs, I was able to immediately dispose of all material possessions and turn them into drugs.
Right, right.
And which were disposable also.
You were in the position on in interviews and stuff as being spokesperson for the hippies. How did you feel about that?
Well, I wasn't sure that, and I'm still not sure, you know, that rock and roll is an art form. So I was always sort of suspicious of the whole setup, you know, of everything that was going on. The only time I really felt that it had a lot of validity was during the Monterey Pop Festival.
Which you produced.
Yeah, well, I co-produced with Lou Adler.
That was the first big pop or rock outdoor festival like that. And it really was the forerunner of Woodstock and all of the
By the time Woodstock had come along, the world had changed so drastically. It was a completely different audience, a completely different way of looking at the world. And it was the beginning of heavy metal rock and of the Me Generation. And
what was the concept behind Monterey?
Monterey was to try to make it a musical event to bring people from all over the world together. And a non-profit organization would profit from this. And scholarships would be given out. And it was a tremendous success. Everyone came from all over the planet, you know. And they all came to Monterey. And all they received was their airfare there and their airfare to their next job and expenses while they were there. And they gave up all their film rights and recording rights and residuals and everything to this charitable organization.
It's really such a great document now, too, especially considering so many of the performers are dead now,
thank God we made
too.
It, you know, because many of those people, it's the only real footage of them, you know, that's really so intense and valid and dramatic, you know, of Jimi Hendrix, for instance, you know. Taking out a lighter fluid can and lighting his guitar. No one knew Jimmy was going to do that.
Oh, really?
You know? I mean, he was very sneaky about that.
Would you have wanted to be warned about that as the co-producer of the concert?
No, you know, I thought it was hilarious. You know, it was almost as good as when he was making love to his amp.
This might sound like a dumb question, but did you feel like you got any insights into performers and the performing life by working on arrangements with so many other performers who each had like their own trip that they were into and their own needs that had to be met and so on?
Well, I learned a lot about administration, you know, about the music business itself, you know, because of dealing with 30 groups coming from all over the world, you know, with Ravi Shankar and Pete Townsend and Brian Jones came in for, you know, for the festival and It was really a difficult logistical thing to put together. I probably could have fought a war after that, you know, and like planned D-Day and gotten away with it or something.
It seems that it wasn't long after the Monterey Pop Festival that things started to fall apart for the group.
Well, you know, that right after the Monterey Pop Festival was when Monterey Pop Festival was in May, I suppose. Of 67, and in October of 67 was when we actually broke up.
What were some of the reasons why you broke up?
Well, there were a couple of reasons. One was the underlying effect of all the different affairs the group members had had with each other and things like that, and the difficulty of men and women living in close quarters, caged animals, you know, sex rearing its ugly head and things like that. And another reason was that we just could not keep up the creativity. We were burned out emotionally from all the tension we had created for ourselves. And we were burned out on LSD. And we were burned out artistically. We had just worked so hard in that 3-year period in the studio, just day after day after day, 18-hour days, under the influence of drugs. And just on and on and on and on, laying on layer after layer of music and voices and new songs and new harmonies and new arrangements. We started to do a fifth album and we just couldn't match what we had already done at all, couldn't come close to it. And we realized that if we kept the Mamas and Papas going from then on, it was just going to be a downhill thing.
And you didn't want that to happen,
and we
so
started
you split.
Calling it Downhill Records instead of Dunhill Records. And the writing was on the wall, you know. We said, let's just leave this alone. This was very good, these four albums. Let's not play with it, all right? We'll just go home now.
Did you think that you were also maybe getting displaced by newer groups that were moving up the charts?
Well, I think we would have, but we got out of there just in time.
Were the bands that you resented at that point for their success?
No. I don't think we ever felt that way. You know, we were so happy with what we had done. And so, you know, maybe it doesn't sound right to say, but we were really proud of what we had done musically. That we were never jealous of anybody, you know.
You didn't think like certain new bands were making your sound dated?
No, but the only thing that was making me angry was that Madison Avenue was taking over our sound. You know, and every commercial on the radio and on television sort of sounding like, you know, with Mama's and Papa's harmonies and male-female thing. And
can you name a couple?
No, I can't. As a matter of fact, we'll all be sued.
It seems like you were all starting to go a little berserk at around that time,
yeah,
too.
Well, you know, when you take that much acid in that short amount of time, you know, we thought everyone was sort of taking it. We didn't know that we were sort of like out there on the cutting edge of, you know, psychedelia. We had no idea, really. We went to a fellow named Dr. Cohn in Los Angeles at UCLA, Dennis and I. And because we were like, our nervous systems were like, you know, our hands were shaking and we couldn't eat and things, you know, we were dropping forks and things like that, you know. And he was like, you know, in charge of nervous disorders at UCLA. And he said, well, why are you guys this way? Well, I mean, tell me about an average day for you. Well, we get up, we take our acid. He says, you do what? You know, we take our acid. And he says, what do you take acid every day? He said, well, not every day, but, you know, like 4 or 5 times a week at least, you know. He says, well, how long have you been doing this? I said, well, for 2.5, 3 years. He said, oh, my God, you're lucky you're alive. And then he took us on a tour of his psychiatric ward, and he showed us so many real burnouts, people who did have bad trips and bad experiences who never came back. And he said, that's what you guys really should be, is in there. He said, after what you've done to yourselves, you've got to stop this right now.
Did you stop?
Not immediately, no. We did cut down to once a week, though.
Mama Cass was kind of sick at that time too, wasn't she?
Well, you know, we had to attempt a fifth album to get out of our contracts.
I called her Mama Cass. Anyways,
out of our contract with Dunhill, you know, we had to do a fifth album because we owed them 3 more. They said, "Give us one. Just try to do one." This was 2 years. This was in 1971. We hadn't sung together in almost 3 years. No one wanted to do it, you know. And Lou didn't want to produce it. But we all wanted to get out of our contracts, and they offered us a lot of money to try to do the album. So we said, okay. Well, so I ended up producing the album. And I never had all 4 of the Mamas and Papas in the studio at the same time. And I put Denny's part on. It was in the ether someplace, a harmony part. Like, la, 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 which I had in my mind would go with this other part that I have Cass put on later, because Denny and Cass weren't talking. Then Cass would come in. Then Michelle would come in, because Michelle wasn't talking to Denny or Cass. And she'd turn her back on me, and I was in the booth, and she'd sing out to the wall. And, you know, the album, I don't know, somehow we finally got it made. But Cass was very ill at that time. She had her own nurse that came to the sessions with her and took her blood pressure and things like that, and said, well, you know, she can't sing that part. That part's too high. Or she has to go home now.
How'd she get so sick?
I don't know. I guess it was the result of all the drugs, you know, that we had all taken.
And crash dieting?
And crash dieting, the diuretics and things like that, yeah.
I guess it was about that time, too, that the Manson murders, and Polanski was a good friend of yours, right?
Yeah. Well, that's really bizarre what happened, you know, with Roman and myself. I was very good friends with Roman and Sharon. Roman was in Europe at the time, and Marshall Brickman and I were out just sort of roaming around town that night. We were supposed to go up to Sharon's house, Polanski's house. I was a business partner of Jay Sebring's, as a matter of fact, in his hair care product company. He conned me out of $10,000 somehow to get involved in his business, you know. Sebring International, it was called. And Marshall said he didn't feel like being inside that night. You know, Marshall's a hilarious guy to be around, very, very funny. And he said that he understood that there were luminous plankton out at Malibu that night, and shouldn't we go out there and stand on the palisades and look at them? So I said, well, okay, whatever, you know, whatever you want to do, Marshall will do. And so that's what actually happened. We went out to the beach that night, and that was the night the murders occurred. And then Roman came back, and he moved into the beach house of Michael Sarn, along with myself, and the 3 of us were living there. And I found out later that Roman thought that I was, you know, responsible for Sharon's murder.
You found out when he came at you with a meat cleaver.
Well, even then I wasn't sure. I thought that maybe he was just cracking up and accusing everybody. Wasn't until, you know, he...
Oh, but he wasn't... It was just you, he thought?
Yeah. Yeah, he actually borrowed a forensic set from the LAPD and went through all my clothing and automobiles and things like that, looking for blood samples and things, you know, to match up. Had my handwriting analyzed to see that, you know, the pig was scrawled on the wall and blood to see if my handwriting matched the pig on the wall. These bizarre things, you know.
How did you convince him it wasn't you?
Well, what happened was he grabbed me by my hair and put the meat cleaver to my neck, and he said, did you kill Sharon? And I said, no. And he said, did you kill Sharon? And I could just feel this edge, this cutting edge. And, you know, Roman's extremely strong. And I said, no, Roman, I didn't. But if you don't put that meat cleaver down, I might kill you in a moment. You know, I'm getting very angry. And he threw it across the room, and it, you know, quivered. It was like one of his movies. It went into the wall and then stuck there. And I thought that it was just sort of a mental breakdown on his part. I didn't realize that he really was serious about that. At the time. It wasn't until his book came out years later, and he said in his book, and I thought that John had been involved in this, and I was so shocked that I had been such a friend to him and to Sharon, you know, and that he actually had thought this, and that was a serious incident that had happened at the beach, not just an aberrance of behavior one night.
My guest is John Phillips, and he's written an autobiography called Papa John. After the Mamas and Papas disbanded, you went through a period of trying to do a Broadway show, of doing, I think, one or two independent records by yourself. But none of that stuff was very commercially successful.
Not at all.
But also around that period in the 1970s, that's when you started shooting up and really getting into hard drugs. What led to that? And I ask that knowing that you'd already seen friends of yours OD on drugs, so you weren't naive about...
No, I wasn't at all naive.
And you'd seen what had happened to you from taking all the acid.
Yeah. I don't think that's ever a deterrent. A friend of yours, I mean, a lot of friends of mine had seen a lot of their friends die from drugs, and then they died from drugs. And why I didn't die from drugs, I'll never know. Just luck of the draw, I guess. But I had a string of things that didn't really satisfy me, and starting with the Wolf King album, which I never really I loved the songs I'd written for it, but I didn't like the way I sang on it. I thought it was, you know, I was very depressed. I'd broken up with Michelle again, of course, and I had just started living with Genevieve Waite, the girl I eventually married, and then I produced a movie called Brewster McLeod, and that Robert Altman directed. And I thought I was going to make millions of dollars on that because it was this first movie after MASH, and that made no money whatsoever. It was it's a beautiful cult film now, but it never made a penny. And then I did the score for Myra Breckinridge, which was the biggest bomb movie in the world. And then I wrote my own Broadway show, and I found out that Broadway was a series of committee decisions. You know, it wasn't the same way as the music business. And by the time it got to stage, and Andy Warhol produced it, and Paul Morrissey directed it, and another Philadelphia boy, Andy Warhol. And it wasn't anything to do with the show I'd written in the first place by the time it got to stage. You know, I was even trying to get my name off it before opening night, and it got the worst reviews in the history of Broadway. It's still unequaled for bad reviews. I just got depressed. I formed a little act with Genevieve, and we did a cabaret act, and a guy said I sang like a frog, and that my voice sounded like a frog, and that depressed me. And then I got a chance to go to London to do the film score and then to sing the score for The Man Who Fell to Earth, David Bowie film. And I went to London, and I ran into Keith Richard again, and we started living together, and he helped me work on the score, as did Mick Taylor. And Jagger and Richards and I have been friends for years and years and years by that time, you know, 10 years anyway. And Keith was very heavily into heroin at that time. And when we started living together, there was always heroin around the house. And I had become just callous toward drug use, because I've been doing it for so many years, and it just to watch Keith, you know, Keith somehow was able to maintain on it, you know, and just sort of still do his work and play his music and so forth. And so I started experimenting with it, and so did Genevieve. And next thing I knew, I was addicted to it.
How did you know when you were actually addicted?
My nose started running. You know, I had, my eyes started getting red, and I was feeling clammy in the morning and things like that. And I thought I was getting the flu. And Keith said, "No, you, what you need to fix, you know." And at that moment, I had a decision to make. You know, there was some heroin on the table, and there was a whole world outside, and I took the heroin. And it took me a long time to get over it.
Did it ever get to the point where, like, your sources, you had enough money, at least at the beginning, to buy from people who wouldn't necessarily give you a lot of trouble? You didn't have to go on the streets to buy. But did it ever get to the point where you had to go to, like, shooting galleries and you know, like, really awful street places to get drugs?
Well, not really until, I guess, 1980. I mean, I had a drugstore in New York City that I had an arrangement with the pharmacist there to get all pharmaceutical drugs, pharmaceutical cocaine, pharmaceutical morphine, Dilaudids, Dioxins. And it was like a drug supermarket for me. And so I would just go in there with a shopping bag once a week and take all the drugs off the shelves and pay them twice the retail value and walk off with them. And then we'd all just pass them around, you know. And then when the DEA closed that drugstore down, that's when I did hit the streets and tried to clean up and had that incredible 4th of July weekend I just referred to in the book when Mick and Jerry Hall came out to visit us in the Hamptons for the weekend. And I tried to burn the house down, and we were going through violent withdrawal and wrecked my car, and Mick took my kids away from me, wouldn't give them back because I was so crazed at the time. And he was absolutely right, as it turned out. He had warned me before in London, you know. He said, gee, you know, you're doing too much of this stuff. Don't you think you're doing, you know, he has the master of understatement, you know. And I was cooking up some heroin in the kitchen of my house and about to inject it. And Mick said, don't you think you're doing a bit much of that, you know. I said, no, I can handle it, no problem. He said, oh, okay. And he walked in, that's all he ever really said about it. But I could feel him sort of withdraw a bit from me, bit by bit, at that time.
If you weren't busted and if you didn't enter a therapy program because of that, do you think you would have stopped on your own?
No. I tried a lot. I tried many times, and I wasn't able to do it. And I never tried it, you know, in a therapeutic situation, an actual hospital or rehab. With intensive, you know, psychiatry and group therapy and things like that. And I don't think that it's a possible thing to do, you know, to kick a hardcore heroin habit by yourself. I don't know anyone to do it yet. And anybody who's interested in a bit of advice, if you have a drug problem, first thing you have to do is identify it. You know, and say, I have a drug problem. And then you have to check in somewhere and get some help. And then comes the real long withdrawal. And it's not just the physical withdrawal, it's the psychological withdrawal that's so difficult.
After you were busted, before your sentencing, you did a lot of media work trying to talk to people about the dangers of drugs and everything. And I figured that might have seemed just a little ironic to you, since you knew from your own experiences that nothing's going to talk you out of it if you're determined to do it. I mean, as you'd pointed out, you'd seen friends die, and it doesn't make you stop. Even when you see what's happening to yourself, it doesn't make you stop, and it doesn't, you know, seeing other people's examples doesn't even necessarily make you not start, you know?
Yeah. So I wasn't really trying to talk to my own age group.
Uh-huh.
I was trying to, you know, with McKenzie and I did a lot of that together, as you know, and we were really trying to aim it toward high school kids and grade school kids, you know, eighth graders and people like that, people who hadn't had a chance to develop really hard drug habits, and to try to tell them, you know, watch it, because this is very, very dangerous stuff we're playing with here.
Yeah, for you, you had started with drugs, for, you know, smoking grass and then doing a lot of psychedelics. And then you were pretty mature by the time you started shooting. You were in your 30s, right?
No, I was
in your 40s?
When I started, I was 40 years old, yeah.
You must have been really upset, though, when you found out that your two oldest children were starting to do hard drugs when they were in their teens.
Yeah, well, and a lot of that was, you know, because of me. Because that was the way they were trying to get my attention, you know. Because I was so involved in drug use. For instance, I don't think Mackenzie ever would have developed any kind of a drug habit anywhere near. I'm sure she would have experimented with drugs like most, you know, kids do. But I think, you know, she's always been a sensible kid, and she would have pulled back and kept on with her career, and she had a great career going. But her need to communicate with her father, was the only way she could find to do it was, you know, through drugs.
When you were on probation, did they monitor you constantly to check your body fluids and see if you were doing any drugs?
I've been looking for a term like that.
What, body fluids?
Yes.
sum it all up in one term.
Right. Yes, they did. They did all the time. And as a matter of body fluids, I won't forget that. You put some of your body fluids in this jar, please. I constantly gave them body fluids. I had a very, you know, I had an easier time than most people. Like when I went into the rehab, I was 45 years old. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was the oldest guy. And I mean, most of the people were 19 years old or 20 years old. Here I was 45, you know, in group therapy with people who were old enough, you know, to be my grandchildren almost, you know. It was a bizarre situation. Plus, you know, my daughter and my son were there, and my wife was there, and the whole family was in hospital at the same time. So I was monitored very heavily during probation. And plus the fact that I did a lot of work since 1982 in casino towns like Las Vegas and Reno, Atlantic City, Tahoe, where you have to register as a known felon, as a narcotics felon, with the police upon arrival within 24 hours and give precious bodily fluids to them so they can analyze them. So I was very heavily monitored.
Now that you're not going to be monitored anymore because you're off probation, are you, you know, pretty certain you've got the strength of will to not go back on drugs?
Well, I certainly hope so, you know, but it's something you have to always keep your guard up against because of that psychological addiction, which takes so long to overcome, and the flashbacks that occasionally occur to anyone who's, you know, been exposed to drugs for as long a period as I was.
Back in the 60s, when marijuana and then psychedelics started, like, entering the youth culture,
yeah,
so to speak, there were all these warnings from the mainstream society of marijuana leads to heroin. And,
yeah.
You know, and then there were all these people who were, there were all these contests of who was right and who was wrong. You know, was the counterculture right or were they wrong? And a lot of people who were the adults of the period were just waiting to be proved correct. And I wouldn't surprise me if you've run into a lot of people who look at your life and say, okay, renounce your past now and show that you and everything about the period you grew up in was wrong. Has that happened to you?
Well, I mean, yeah, a lot of things in it were misrepresented. I don't know if they were wrong or not. I'd like to address the marijuana question for a moment,
yeah.
You know, because I'm interested in that because I've worked in rehabs now for the last 6 years, and I've worked with hundreds and hundreds of heroin addicts over the last 6 years, and I don't know any of them who didn't start with marijuana. So it's sort of a strong argument that out of the people who do smoke marijuana, a certain amount of them are going to become junkies. And if you start using it, then you're putting yourself in a percentile group where, and the actuary figures are that, you know, a certain amount of people out of that group of people who use marijuana will go on to harder drugs, because it is a progressive kind of obsession and addiction.
But have you had any desire to, like, renounce your past or?
No, I wish I could change some of it. Mm-hmm. Mostly changing my lack of being a proper role model for my children, you know.
Right.
I mean, it's really the most painful thing, not really being there during the tender years, you know, to take care of them. I'm very lucky to have had have a second chance now to do it. That I have a 6-year-old kid named Bijou, who's great, and a 15-year-old boy named Tam, and it's really a privilege, you know, to be able to give them what I wasn't able to give the other children.
One of the things I thought was very funny in your book is that your son Tamerlane, I'm sorry, who you call Tam, changed his name to Michael when he got old enough.
Yeah, well, Tamerlane, you know, was a Mongol conqueror who built a city of jade. And there was a play by Marlowe called Tamerlane the Great. And then there was a poem by Edgar Allan Poe called Tamerlane also. And my wife Genevieve and I loved the name Tamerlane. And we also liked the work of Virginia Woolf, the novelist. And our favorite novel by her at the time was Orlando. So we named him Tamerlane Orlando Phillips. You know, he hated the name from the time he was old enough to say it.
I know you try to be so distinctive and giving him a unique name.
And then he looked it up in the census, the U.S. population census, and he was the only boy in America named Tamerlane. And so he found out the most popular name was Michael, and now he's changed his name to Michael.
One last thing, is it just coincidence that you and Michelle Phillips have just written memoirs at exactly the same time?
Yeah, it is. Isn't that strange?
Yeah, it is. Have you read hers yet?
Yeah, I have read hers. I've just finished it, as a matter of fact.
Does it jive with the way you tell the stories?
A lot of it does, yeah. I mean, you know, different viewpoints on different situations, you know, that are very personal ones, which is to be expected, I guess, yeah.
So what are you doing now musically?
I intend on sort of re-entering into the music industry now that I'm off probation. I didn't want to really be out there doing that kind of thing while I was on probation, because it was just too much risk to other people for me to be around and things like that. You know, it's a long story about that. But now that I feel, you know, strong enough to go back in and regulate my life properly and still do the music, and I'm touring with the Mamas and Papas, and we're playing everywhere. And we're getting lots of offers to record as the Mamas and Papas, which we're turning down because we don't want to call ourselves the Mamas and Papas on record.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to call it like Cats and Mice or something, or Cheese, or whatever. It doesn't make any difference, really. But we don't want to play around with what the original Mamas and Papas did, because you can't really replace Cass and you can't replace Michelle. And Spanky and Mackenzie aren't trying to replace them. You know, I mean, they're stars in their own right, and that's the way it should be.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I appreciate it.